Good evening. Welcome to the Slayer Report. Today is January 25th, 2018. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, our theme for the 2017 annual wrap-up, does your pension fund have a deep state drain? I'm sure you've looked at the cover of our annual wrap-up. It's a cow being milked by a farmer, and there's a hole in the bucket, and the milk is going downstairs, being delivered to all sorts of deep state activities. So you know my prejudice. I think the answer is yes. I wanted to take a look at the pension funds because I wanted to do several things. One is I don't believe the narrative that we're seeing on pension funds, and so I want to talk about that narrative and refute it. That's number one. Number two, I want to make sure that you're not frozen in fear by the narrative or don't have a good conceptual overview of what's happening, because I think it's going to make it much easier for each one of us in our different and unique positions to start to understand what the impact of what's happening with pension funds is going to be on us and know what to, or start to develop a way of dealing with it. I'd like to start, I've got a presentation up on the web presentation that is not done yet. You can look at some of the graphs and charts, but the text isn't finished. So just remember, it's a work in progress. It'll be done sometime next week. But I'd like to read my introduction because it sums up what I think is wrong with the narrative that we're watching now. Our planetary governance and financial system currently operates significantly outside the law. Whether the cost of war, organized crime, corruption, environmental damage, suppression of technology, or secrecy, this lawlessness and the lawlessness it encourages in the general population represents a heavy and expensive drag on all aspects of our society, our economy, and our landscape. Pension fund underfunding in the United States is a symptom of that drag. It is not a self-contained crisis. We are told that we can fix pension funds by saving more, whether by upping the contributions from beneficiaries and or taxpayers. As portrayed in the graphic on the cover of the 2017 annual wrap-up, this is the equivalent of trying to fill a milk bucket by milking more cows when the problem is we have a hole in the bucket. Why put more milk in the bucket until the hole is fixed or the farmer gets a new bucket? If my subscribers and clients are representative, many people in the U.S. general population, whether as beneficiary or taxpayer, are reluctant to invest more money in the retirement system. Many do not trust it. They do not trust some pension fund governance and management to treat beneficiaries' interest as primary. They do not trust money managers to invest wisely. They believe Wall Street will promote fraudulent securities. They do not trust central banks or the federal government or some state and local governments to behave responsibly. They are concerned that laws and regulations will be changed in an unfavorable manner. The decision to avoid increased investment in pension plans or retirements may, in fact, be a wise decision, albeit it makes the underfunding crisis worse. Addressing pension fund underfunding in the United States will require returning integrity to pension fund governance and investment policies where it has been eroded, or returning to a successful system of household and family wealth where individuals control the governance and management of their own assets, instead of depending on centrally controlled systems. Whichever path we take, the success of our pension fund and retirement assets and their impact on financial markets and society will necessitate addressing the integrity of U.S. government and corporate governance, and the global financial system. This is the same point that we make repeatedly on the Solari Report. Our economy is a dynamic ecosystem. We cannot isolate one part and fix it. If there is a fundamental imbalance, such as corruption or lawlessness, it must be dealt with on a cross-cutting basis. If our political process delivers profits and cheap cost of capital to insiders and considers the general population expendable, the solution is not for everyone else to save more in the face of overwhelming fiscal, monetary, and financial debasement and demands by the insider group. The solution is to address the fundamental corruption of the political mechanism. Over the long run, the privileges afforded the few are shrinking the total pie. I chose pension funds as the theme for the 2017 annual wrap-up because I wanted to invest time in reviewing the current state of global and U.S. pension funds. For a complete list of the most useful studies, books, and articles I read, as well as website sources I use, see our bibliography section. My goal in doing so is to help you reject the official narrative, not get frozen in fear or overwhelmed by the complexity of it, and give you a simple overview of the situation that can help you successfully navigate the specific aspects that touch you and your family, either as a beneficiary or taxpayer. If you are a U.S. citizen, you are going to have to deal with the failure to fully fund pension funds and health care promises. It will touch you as a taxpayer. If you are in a state where the state and local pension funds are significantly underfunded, the impact on your state and local taxes could be significant. It may impact or determine in which state or locality, in fact, you choose to live. It will also impact you as federal taxpayers for military and government employee obligations, as well as obligations assumed by the pension benefit guarantee corporation as companies fail or shed their pension funds in bankruptcy. Alternatively, if you're depending on income from one or more pension funds that reduces their benefits as a result of underfunding, or they fail and are assumed by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, it could impact your quality of life, your life expectancy, and your health. This also extends to family and friends. If your parents' pension benefits are canceled and they show up at your door wanting to live with you, you're likely not going to tell them, "Sorry, it's not my problem." In addition, there are numerous things happening in the world, from war, environmental problems, significant credit problems in the fixed income markets, or loss of reserve currency status for the dollar, that could significantly decrease the value of pension fund returns and assets. This is one of many reasons why the health of the whole economy and financial system should be important to all of us. The state of our current pension fund system is one of the reasons I keep harping on the financial coup d'etat, including trillions of dollars of bailouts and money missing from the U.S. government. You cannot be sure trillions to fund contractual and legally obligated pension promises and then let $50 trillion plus, my estimate, simply walk out the monetary and fiscal doors when you have no legal obligation to provide that $50 trillion, let alone a legal basis for doing so. So let's review the current state of U.S. and global pension funds and see if we can't change the narrative. There is no pension fund crisis. This so-called crisis is the result of a leadership decision that the elderly are expendable. After buying their votes and labor with promises, the leadership is wiggling out of those promises by not funding on a pay-as-you-go basis, then cutting benefits and throwing retirees overboard. Rather than paying for nursing homes, we prefer to expand the billionaire class and use private savings to provide low-cost capital to the national security state, automate with robotics and AI, and invest in space in the transition to a multiplanetary civilization. This is a political choice. It is not a financial crisis. It is a plan that has been engineered for two decades of intentional central bank and government policies and related enforcement designed to centralize and reorganize the economy accordingly. It is a conscious and intentional abrogation of legal obligations, just as the housing bubble represented a fraudulent inducement. The financial crisis is what will happen and is happening now as beneficiaries and taxpayers get left holding the bag. Okay, so let's look at total pension fund assets. One of the best sources of pension fund statistics is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, usually referred to as OECD. It's based in Paris and has 35 nations as members. They're primarily developed countries, but it has a few emerging market economies as well. In 2017, they they published a pension study called Pension Markets in Focus 2017 edition, and it's an overview of the status of global pension funds. It's important, as I quote from it, that to remember that when reviewing their tables and charts, they're drawing from non-national data sources. Their members are providing data, other countries are providing data, and that data is non-conforming. So the methodology by which it's calculated in one country could be very different than another country. So you just have to approach the data with that grain of salt, if you will. As of 2016, the global pension fund assets totaled almost $40 trillion, of which $38 trillion was in the OECD countries, that 35 countries, and essentially a little bit more than a trillion was in all the non-OECD countries. Of that amount, 25 trillion was in the United States. So U.S. pension assets are approximately 62.5% of global pension fund assets for what is approximately 4.3% of the world's population. So let me say that again. The United States is 4.3% of the world's population, but 62.5% of global pension funds. Now, part of that is most retirement savings outside of the OECD countries is in households. It's not centrally controlled. So if you come to the United States before World War II and certainly before the 20th century, the vast majority of retirement savings was held in households and not centrally managed and controlled. From the point of view of China, the U.S. pensioners are in great shape. So China has 18.3% of the world's population as compared to our 4.3%. So basically almost four times as many people, and a little bit more than four times. And despite the fact that China has a significant aging population, it has less than 1% of the world's pension assets. So we have 4% of the population and 60% of the pension fund assets, and China has 18.3% of the world's population, but 1% of the world's pension assets. So it's a wonder that China is trying to create a global currency and considering plans to reduce treasury holdings. Not at all. Because if you look at one of the ways we've been able to do what globally is still a magnificent blessing in terms of pension fund savings, the major reason we were able to do it is because we had the reserve currency. So I show two charts from the OECD study that show the total assets in the largest OECD countries, and then for all countries plus non-members as well. It's very fascinating. So you can get a complete breakdown by country, by region, and look at it from 2006 to 2016. As of 2016, Denmark, the Netherlands, Canada, and Iceland all had higher assets as a percent of GDP in their pension funds than the U.S. Switzerland was close behind the U.S., and those countries plus the U.S. and Switzerland constitute the countries that are above the weighted average for assets as a percent of GDP. If you want to see or read a very inspiring story, read there's a book that one of the books I linked to in the bibliography, The Third Rail, Confronting Our Pension Failures by Jim Leach. And he tells the story how Netherlands faced the problems or faced the issues that the boomers' retirement or the stress it would put on their pension fund system, and implemented all sorts of reforms and has managed to keep one of the world's soundest and best managed pension fund systems. Anyway, you can read that section in the Third Rail if you're interested. But it's proof positive that an open society can address and manage retirement systems responsibly. It is possible in a democratic system to do that. And I appreciate the Netherlands is a smaller country than the United States. But, we have plenty of states and local areas that are small too. So the OECD figures have approximately $25 trillion for U.S. pension funds. Let's look at how that breaks down. As of the end of 2016, the Investment Company Institute reported total U.S. retirement assets of $25.3. IRAs were the largest component with an estimated $7.85 trillion. And that's very significant. Add defined contribution plans as opposed to defined benefit plans. They were $7.03 trillion. So that's almost $15 trillion of that $25 trillion. And that's interesting because those are both retirement mechanisms where there's no defined or guaranteed benefit. Your wealth goes up and down with the market. The government defined benefit plans were 5.46. The private sector defined benefit plans were 2.9 trillion. So as you can see, at about $8 trillion, they are They are a much smaller percentage of pension funds than they were for the 20 years after World War II. Let's see. Within the defined contribution plans, 401k plans accounted for $4.8 trillion, and other private sector defined contribution plans had $550 billion in assets, of which, or $905 billion was 403b plans, $282 billion was held by 457 plans, and $467 billion in assets were in the Federal Retirement Thrift Savings Plan. So what we're seeing is much more movement to get out of defined benefits, both by government and corporations. If you look at the public plans data, which is one of the sources we mentioned, the combined value of defined benefit plan assets held by state and local government was $3.85 trillion. Now, that compares to a funding need of approximately $4.58 trillion. So it looks like these are the top 95%, but it looks like they're approximately 72% funded. I just wanted to read a couple points from Moody's. The unfunded liabilities of the various federal, now I'm going to talk about, I talked about corporate, I talked about state and local, now I'm going to talk about federal. The unfunded liabilities of the various federal employee pension systems covering civilian and military employee benefits amounts to about $3.5 trillion, or 20% of U.S. GDP. Additionally, Moody's estimates that unfunded state and local pension fund liabilities are of the same magnitude, bringing the total shortfall to about 40% of GDP. Their estimate for the underfunding for state and local is greater than public plans. The bigger challenge to the U.S. comes from the unfunded liabilities for the Social Security and Medicare programs. The Social Security funding gap is estimated at $13.4 trillion. This is the mother lode, or 75% of GDP, while the shortfall from the hospital insurance component of the Medicare program amounts to $3.2 trillion, or 18% of GDP. Interestingly enough, if you look at some of the Pew research reports on the state and local, what they point out is that the funding shortfall, with the exception of some really states that have gotten themselves in a real mess, is really not that bad. What you do have is you really don't have funding for healthcare. And so what you see for both, for corporations, for the non-employed population, for Medicare, for the state and local guys, the one of the big problems is Medicare, which is why we've seen so much emphasis at the federal level to try and come up with healthcare solutions. And then another quote from Bill Bergman's blog, author Tom McKinney writing, and this was on the U.S. Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund as of 2015. The U.S. Civil Service Retirement and Disability Fund has just 48% of assets needed to cover future pensions for retired and active federal employees. Currently, there are 2.6 million retired and 2.7 million active federal civilians enrolled, including U.S. Postal Service personnel as of September 30, 2015. The retirement fund pension assets were $880 billion, and the retirement fund pension liabilities were over $1.8 trillion. The $880 billion in pension assets is often referred to as the pension trust fund, etc. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a situation where, yes, U.S. by comparison has an extraordinary amount of assets. If you look at the promise made with respect to both pension benefits and healthcare, they're significant underfunding. I want to step back and look at give a few comments on the history of pension funds, because I have a different viewpoint on it than I think sort of is part of the official narrative. After World War II, when we implemented the Bretton Woods system, whereby the U.S. was really the global protector of the trade and building an open trade model around the world, it was extremely important to the leadership of this country that we be able to create stable labor force and stable labor relations to really take advantage of that system. And pension funds were one of the benefits that were used to create those stable relationships. But the other thing that they did by creating the big corporate pension funds and really government too, was you instead of workers taking home their pay, you were able to create a vehicle whereby they put a certain portion of their pay in a centrally controlled pool. And what that allowed you to do was basically, it's a form of capital aggregation and control. It's capital controls. You know, I'm always laughing and calling the Department of Justice in charge of the control and centralization and concentration of cash flow. You know, and I always call the Patriot Act the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act. But pension funds allowed you to take a country where all the savings was controlled in households and centralize it into a pool that could be controlled centrally and also could be controlled in ways that were remarkably invisible. So if you want to build this global juggernaut of both multinationals and the national security state, you need an enormous flow of capital, and pension funds were part of the different vehicles you use to control and concentrate cash flow. Now, as that system got off on the ground and started going, as globalization kicked in, suddenly you could change your relationship with labor because you started to be able to compete labor globally, and that really took off and was turbocharged after the adaption of the Uruguay Round of GATT and the adoption of the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995. If you haven't watched the Sir James Goldsmith video on globalization at Salera.com, just do a search for Sir James Goldsmith. It's a marvelous introduction and explanation of that system and how devastating it's going to be to labor in Europe and the United States, basically in the developed world. Now, what's interesting, though, is even though you're renegotiating your relationship with labor, you still want and need that centrally controlled capital. And the question is, how do you keep the central control and get out of providing as rich benefits? Of course, switching to defined contribution was one of the ways that that got done. And frankly, corporations dumping pension funds or shutting them on the pension benefit corporation, when the guarantee corporation, when they got that created, was some of the ways. What happened, though, as the boomers started to retire, and this was known for a long time. I was part of my company, Hamilton Securities, did a big effort to study how pension funds could achieve the returns they needed for the boomer, the baby boomer retirement. So you have this huge capital that you have aggregated and concentrated to provide stable, cheap financing to build this multinational juggernaut and the national security state. And the problem with the boomers' retirement is not just that they're going to want their money back now to pay for retirement. So they're putting in a dollar every year. And now the problem, there you got two problems. One is they're not going to put in a new dollar. You need that dollar every year. And not only are they not going to put that dollar in, but now they're going to want to take a dollar out instead, which gives you a $2 problem. And so, whereas you need that dollar to keep flowing, they're going to take it out, and now you got a $2 problem. And it's one of the reasons, if you go back and listen to all my many presentations on the financial coup d'etat, I think they saw the boomer retirements coming and said, okay, we've got to pull all the capital out of these systems before the boomer retirement come due. And then when the boomer retirement comes due, we'll stuff their pension funds full of obligations like mortgage-backed securities in their own homes. We'll bubble the economy and stick the paper in their pension funds. And they can come up with a fiscally responsible solution. You know, they can stew on their own juices. I think they got tired of being in the middle. So if you look at the history of pension funds, I don't see it as something that the country wanted to do for the working population. I think it was something that they used to attract the working population into a certain kind of job and relationship. But the real goal was to concentrate cash flow and control it centrally. And the last thing they wanted to do was lose that cash flow when the boomers retired. The question was how to make sure they got to keep the cash. And I think the financial coup, the answer was the financial coup. They just stole it and used a variety of mechanisms to do it. But one of it was enormous debasement, which is part of what we're all struggling with. Okay, so let's look at recent performance. Thanks to Jason Worth, who did an amazing job of downloading lots of data and putting it into some table and charts to compare it, which you can see in the web presentation. We were able to take a look at how the different sectors in the investment world performed. Now, remember, again, I'm using non-conforming data, so we need to take all of this with a grain of salt, because the relationships are not perfect. I show one chart and one table at the web presentation under recent performance. The first shows a comparison of a series of different investments or benchmarks where I'm showing the average annual investment return from 2007 to 2016. So I'm showing one return for each, and it's the average for that 10-year period. And then below the chart, I show a table of the returns from 2007 to 2016. So you can see the detailed breakdown, and then we have footnotes so you understand what the sources is. But using these numbers, let me just explain. I start off with the Barclays Aggregate Bond Fund, which is an ETF, which will just show you. It's a good benchmark to use for the performance in the bond market. And the average annual investment return was 4.4%. The next bar shows the S&P with dividends. So Barclays is the bonds. S&P with dividends is the U.S. equity market, which is not the global market, just U.S. And then I show so that's 8.8% for the 10-year period. And then I show a 40-60 portfolio, which is 7%. So if we owned all bonds during that period, we would have averaged 4.4%. If we owned all U.S. equities, we would have performed at 8.8% return. And if we owned a 40-60 portfolio of the two, we would have gotten a 7% return. So then if you look at these 170 state and local pension funds, top is basically 95% of the value or the assets of the state and local pension fund universe. Their return for that period was 6.4%, slightly lower than the 40-60 portfolio, which is the proximate allocations, but certainly close enough with different, considerations like having money in cash or alternative investments that may not have done as well as equities, or having extra expenses, you know, could there are many logical reasons for the difference. CalPERS, the largest public pension fund in the country, was 6% for that 10-year period. And then I move into some of the other OECD members. Canadian pension funds, 5.5%, starting to be meaningful below the 40-60 portfolio benchmark. And then UK pension funds, 7.2%, outperforming. And you're ready for the big drop here. USA pension funds for that period, 2.1%, which is remarkable given how well the U.S. equity markets did during that period. So if you look down at the table below, one of the things you can see is in the 2008-2009 period, the U.S. funds experienced a much deeper drop than almost all countries around the world. It was significant. Okay, Australian pensions, 5.6%, below the benchmark, but significantly ahead of the United States. New Zealand, 5.2%, again below the benchmark, but significantly ahead of U.S. pensions. Dutch pensions, 5.9%. Swiss, interestingly enough, at 2.7, down there with the U.S. And then we looked at the university endowments, 7.7% for Harvard. That's really a five-year average since we didn't have all 10 years for Harvard. 7% for Yale, 7.9% for Princeton. So the three university endowments all perform above the benchmark and significantly beyond the United States. That's very interesting for those of you who know my older work. I used to write a lot about the Harvard Endowment and how their investment shenanigans was making a fortune for them, but sticking it to the U.S. federal budget. So I find it unpleasantly amusing that Harvard should be above the benchmark and the U.S. pension fund significantly below. And then finally, we have a number for Berkshire Hathaway, which outperformed everybody. The question is, what is really going on behind the scenes? I said in my my review on the web presentation, it reminds me, the three university endowments at Berkshire Hathaway reminds me of one of my trading partners at Dillon Reed, who whenever one of the traders would outperform the market, would jump up from his desk and tear out on the trading floor and say, "Explain to me why I'm so lucky." Right, in a perfect market, you're not supposed to be able to generate a profit, so he wanted to know why I was so lucky. Below those two charts, we have two other charts from the OECD. One shows the nominal net rate of investment returns for a much wider group of the OECD countries, and as well as non-OECD countries. And you can really see, then we have a investment real rate of return, which is adjusted for inflation. And what you see is the U.S. is way down on the scale, not just of OECD countries, but non-OECD countries as well. And that's the big question. Why did the U.S. perform so poorly? If you look at the U.S. state and local pension funds, they did not perform poorly, which means that the remainder in the basket would have had to perform very, very badly. And my big question, of course, is IRAs and 401ks and defined contribution plans, were they significantly dragging it down? So a review of performance for U.S. pension plans is that their performance was significantly below the benchmark and significantly below their peers globally, and significantly below non-peers as well. So a significantly lower performance, which obviously affected the funding. Now, here's what's interesting. Between 2008 and 2016, you have unprecedented rises in the pension funds. It's clear from the table yes, the problem was they were down in 2008-2009 period much more significantly than their peers in Europe, but or in the Anglo-American alliance. But if you look at the they just didn't begin to get the rise in the U.S. stock market that happened from 2008-2009 to 2016. And the question, of course, is how did that happen? The financial crisis narrative is really, political crisis is a financial crisis narrative, is really focused not so much about the legal and political context and politically how we got to where we are, but simply looking at the assets and the unfunded liability. And there are a couple of big issues in the financial crisis narrative. One is that many pension funds are underfunded, and the political process is not able to effectively deal with that or hasn't effectively changed that. But another is, if you look at the current underfunding assumptions, they assume a rate of return on market performance going forward. And given how high the market is, it's very hard for people to justify that. Part of the challenge with the investment return is that the yield on bonds has come down dramatically since 1980. Now, if interest rates rise, it's going to hurt bond prices, which will hurt some of the bond portfolios, but it will start to provide a bit bigger yield. There's no doubt that the drop in interest rates has been devastating for the funding. So whether it's the current underfunding or the interest rate assumptions in the returns assumptions going forward and they're being too generous, the concern is the underfunding could really be worse than it is. But then you add to it several other facts. One is that pension funds are stuffed full of dollar paper and dollar fixed income paper. And if the U.S. dollar falls in value or we lose status as a reserve currency, or the bond market has significant credit problems, which is possible, the bond bubble bursts, which I think it already has. You could also see a significant drop in the equity market. So many of the folks concerned about a potential fiscal crisis are looking at the inability of the system to improve its funding during a period of what is supposed to be unprecedented recovery in value in the equity markets and supposedly in GNP growth. So in a period when you should replenish the stores, they not only have they not been able to, but liabilities have gone up even more. And so there's real concern about what some of the worst case scenarios could be. The second thing is there's, part of the financial crisis narrative is people need an extraordinary amount of money to be retired, the theory being that you can solve all your problems with money, and if you have enough money, you'll be able to navigate this environment. And if you look at the kind of money that many investment advisors think you need to survive in this environment, there's just no way that families will be able to take money out of their businesses and out of their homes and out of their, sort of many of the activities that families do, like funding college educations, to basically squirrel all that money away. And of course, the problem is when you're in a society which is running the political mechanism to basically train you and your family, of course, that makes it harder and harder for you to save. And the reality is when you do save in many of these mechanisms, you're basically financing them to keep torturing you. So if you're financing your enemy in a system where you're being harvested, the solution to work harder on the treadmill like a little hamster may not be the successful one. So I thought it would help if I used my own financial history to help you understand why I think the official narrative is not the way to look at what's happening. My story starts when I was in a meeting. It's a story I told in Control 101. I've told it many times. It's in the Dylan Reed story about the president of CalPERS in a presentation I was giving them. That he was on a board of an advisory. He's on an advisory board of a subsidiary company of Hamilton Securities. Wonderful group of pension fund leaders, and we were trying to figure out how to turn around the pension fund problems and do it in a way that would be really good for the general economy and the government deficit. Anyway, so I gave a presentation to the group of pension fund advisors, and including the president of CalPERS, the California Public Pension Fund, about how we could basically reorganize government investment by place and take it from a negative return to a positive return and do it in a way that created significant equity value, including for the pension funds. And the president of CalPERS looked at me and he said, "You don't understand, it's too late." And I said, "What do you mean it's too late?" And he said, "They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall." And that was the fall of October 1997, which was the beginning of federal fiscal 1998, which is when the $21 trillion now missing from HUD and DOD started to go missing. Anyway, so that was what clued me into the fact that the governance system of the largest pension fund in the country was not what the law said the governance system was, because if they could dictate a housing bubble that sucked massive amounts of capital out of the country and then get someone like CalPERS to continue to buy all the mortgage-backed securities, ultimately taking significant losses on them in real estate when the bubble burst, then whatever was going on with the fiduciary governance structure was not intact, to say the least. Well, it's very interesting. I then got into a squabble with the U.S. Department of Justice. I was trying to help HUD run its operations clean. It was highly successful, but it meant people were not able to siphon money off of the back door. Now, what's very interesting is when the Department of Justice attacked, they came after every different aspect of my credit and money, both personally and professionally. And one of the things they did before they attacked, they kept it was a process where they demanded huge amounts of make work for subpoena compliance that could literally cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars. And they hit me with a subpoena shortly after they put my 401k under audit. I had $500,000 in a 401k. They put it, I'd used it to finance the company, and then when the company was successful, I paid the 401k back. But it meant I had the vehicle in place and I could use it to finance the company again. And sure enough, what did they do? They put the 401k under audit, which meant I couldn't use it to finance the company. Then they hit me with subpoenas that required about $200,000 of basically make work on backing up servers and doing all sorts of detailed subpoena compliance. And they had me in a squeeze. And so what I did was I said, okay, I know how this works. I busted the 401k, paid $250,000 in taxes, spent the $200,000 on doing the contract compliance. And that was it for me in 401ks. Many years later, when we won the litigation and the government had to arrange to pay my $2.1 million that they owed Hamilton Securities, my CPA said, "Oh, great, let's refund all the money into the 401k. And I said, "Nope, I'm never going to have a 401k again because I've learned my lesson. It's not my money. I have to be in partnership with the U.S. government. They're a totally untrustworthy partner. I'm not going to play." Now, one of the things you know if you've ever worked out the compound interest rate on tax deferral is it's, you know, where it's legal, tax avoidance and tax deferral are profoundly financially attractive. At the same time, you know, my feeling is, given what I do, if I put a dime into a 401k or an IRA, it ain't my money. Now, if you look at there are many situations where I will recommend to a client that they keep their 401k or they keep their IRA for a variety of different reasons. It's very unique to the person, so I'm not saying you shouldn't have a 401k. I'm just saying I consider the U.S. government, for someone in my situation doing what I do, to be a thoroughly untrustworthy partner. And what's very interesting to me is if you look at the headlines these days, including the most recent interview I just posted up at Solari from Bill Binney, the Department of Justice is now openly and blatantly lawless, as lawless openly and blatantly as they were to me. It's kind of funny. They're trying to do to Trump what they tried to do to Bill Binney unsuccessfully, and they tried to do to me unsuccessfully. Anyway, so my attitude is no, I don't need to keep money pouring into a 401k where the government can trap me in it. Now, here's what's interesting. One of the things that happened during the process was I had lent or given $250,000 to friends and families. I know Solari Report subscribers are familiar with our work, have heard this story before, but it was that $250,000, they couldn't seize it. You know, they couldn't get my bank to dirty trick me on that $250,000 because it was out, you know, in the bank accounts and personal assets and savings of all these different members of my family and friends. And I had an uncle who was financially secure and said, well, you know, she's always taking care of everybody else, so, you know, I'll help her. And I hadn't lent or given him any money. He had no need to need money from me, but he had seen me be very generous and help lots of people and family and friends and said, okay, well, you know, she took care of us, so I'll take care of her. Well, those personal loans and gifts and the help from my uncle literally kept me alive, but it was the one source of money that the Department of Justice could never shut off. Now, when I finished the litigation and became an investment advisor, one of the things I noticed was I was looking at clients' portfolios and their balance sheets and seeing that they were desperately trying to fill up their 401ks and IRAs. At the same time, they were not spending sufficient amount of money on their preventative health care, food, or they weren't helping their kids buy homes, or they weren't putting money into their business. They were starving their business for cash, all on the theory that they had to put more money into their 401k and IRA. You know, so, but we had all been trained to think, oh, we've got to have lots of money, you know, that we control in our brokerage account. What they didn't understand is they'd been trained to suck up all the money that they needed for their family, for their health, for their good food, and basically turn it over to the multifamily large corporations to finance the national security state. I mean, does that make sense? And then, of course, there was healthcare. And I have a long article about the 401k and a long article about healthcare, and I'll link to it from this section of the website. But essentially, it was the same deal. I came to the realization after sort of many different situations that I describe in the article that, one, I didn't want to go into the traditional healthcare system. It was increasingly not productive or safe. But two, this thing, healthcare insurance, was a joke. And if I continued to try and keep healthcare insurance, I would not be able to afford healthcare. And in fact, I didn't need healthcare insurance. I needed healthcare. Part of what helped me the most was I went and with one of my relatives to find the original homestead of my family when they came to Tennessee three or four generations back. And we sat and looked at a log cabin with a dirt floor and no windows and no heat and no running water. The 10 people had lived in for the first winter in Tennessee. And I realized, oh, you know, I have thousands of years of ancestors on this planet who have had successful and very long lives. My family's very long lived, without health care insurance and without pensions and without disability insurance and all these things that, as a very successful professional person, I thought I needed. Anyway, but I described the sort of breaking that trance in this article, and it was really a life-changing experience. Then I had a pension fund from my work on Wall Street, and occasionally, as I was organizing my finances, I would call up the bank that now owned the bank that had bought the company that I worked for, and try and get signed up on their online system for my pension fund. And they would deny that I was in a pension fund and they had any obligation to provide me with a pension fund. I finally got frustrated with them, so I had my lawyer call. And again, they denied that I was in the plan, which was just not true, and I had documentation, but I was struggling. And they sort of didn't recognize and wouldn't recognize the documentation. Well, interestingly enough, I had a partner who persuaded me that I ought to check out applying for pension for Social Security early, because if you look at what I could do in terms of investment with any cash flow from Social Security, he figured even though I was giving up a lot of benefits later on, I'd probably come out better off. So I decided to go through the process, and in the process, I got a document from Social Security that authenticated and confirmed that the pension fund and the company had sent a confirmation to the Department of Labor that I was in the pension fund. So now I had a government document that the pension fund itself had reported my being a beneficiary, which is pretty tight legal documentation. So I called the bank again, and lo and behold, they insisted I wasn't in the pension fund. So I sent them the document. And then about 3 weeks later, I get a call from a person from the bank who is clearly way too senior to be doing customer service, even for a situation like this. Now, I suspect, but can't prove, that what had happened was that for political reasons, someone made sure my name was out of the database, and after investigation, they discovered, oh, we need to put it back in. So it could have been my old partners trying to make sure I couldn't get my pension fund, but it could simply be the pension fund trying to wiggle out of as many obligations as they had to. Whatever the reason was, certainly I got the world's most charming and unctuous customer service and proceeded over the next month or two to get online and get hooked up for my pension fund. The process really left me, no matter how bad the corruption fraud is, it's always really kind of shocking. It's like being dropped from a seesaw to have it touch you like that. And what I realized was there was an intentional conscious effort to cheat me out of my pension fund. And frankly, if it hadn't been for the honest civil service in the U.S. government, I would have been out a significant flow of income for the rest of my life. So, it's not the first time the civil service and their competency is honesty has pulled my chestnuts out of the fire. Anyway, so between what happened with the 401k and then what happened with the pension fund, I don't have a lot of confidence in the U.S. pension system. Now, I'm far from a random sample, but we're looking at a financial system where the governance and the enforcement is now so corrupt that it's really very difficult to have any kind of confidence in all aspects of the system. Now, let me keep going because I'm just going to go through my balance sheets as it relates to retirement assets. One of the biggest sources of retirement wealth is capital gains on your home and your home base. I had a very beautiful sort of small mansion in Washington, and in the process of the litigation discovered incredible jealousy and anger coming from the people attacking about how beautiful my home was. I proceeded to sell my home and just about every possession in it, all my antiques, all my I had an art collection, everything, including selling family antiques back to relatives. I was able to keep those in the family. But at various times, I had my house and my possessions used as weapons against me. When I went traveling, every time I came back, there was one thing of great sentimental or financial value stolen. And so I made a decision, not only am I selling everything, but the things that don't sell, I'm just going to make a list of everything that has any sentimental or financial value and give it to my relatives. And I did. But when I got the money back, I said, you are never going to use my possessions as a weapon against me again. And so I'm going to buy the smallest possible home I can buy. And I'm going to buy something that I'm going to be as self-sufficient as possible. So I don't have to depend on your fluoridated water. And I'm going to buy it in an area where costs are extremely modest and taxes are extremely modest. If you look at my combined, I have three properties in Hickory Valley. My combined property taxes on all three properties are approximately $500 a year. So let's just say there's terrible state and local municipal funding problems and they triple my property taxes. I'm paying $1,500. Now, I know of people in states or high-cost areas with high property taxes. You know, if they double your property taxes, it can destroy the value of the real estate. It can't destroy the value of my real estate. My real estate is worth barely anything. It can't be destroyed. There's not enough to destroy. Anyway, so the same thing. You know, I didn't try and buy a home in an area where I thought I could get good capital gains. I knew if I bought something out in San Francisco, I could get good capital gains. I didn't want it. I wanted to be able to put my money in the things that had worked out for me. The number one was I took about $500,000 and bonused it out to the people who'd helped me survive and succeed. So I had a series of people working for me without which, you know, I wouldn't be alive today, or people who'd been generous and gifted me, loaned me money, I gifted and loaned them back. And I just said, you know, I was very convinced that the friendly folks at the Department of Justice were going to arrange for the IRS to go after me. And I knew if the money wasn't there, there would be nothing to go after. And I said, you know, I'm going to bonus this out because the thing that kept me alive were the personal loans and gifts. So, and what's interesting is I had loaned and gifted $250,000, but what came back was not necessarily from all the people, you know, it wasn't tit for tat by each person. So it was sort of like the great Mandela, you put it out and it comes back. So I said, okay, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to hoard. I'm going to put it back out and make money on my company. I'm going to put money into a company. I didn't, you know, I knew that if I sat around and invested in Netflix and Amazon, I could make a lot of money, but I didn't come here to make a lot of money. I came here to make a difference. So I wanted to put it into my company. Now, one of the reasons I chose to stay in Tennessee was, if you look, I spent a fair amount of time going through the state budgets and the state pension fund system. And if you look at the pension fund system here in terms of funding, it's one of the best in the country. And it was surprisingly well managed. I was very impressed the time I went through, an extremely conservative managed. If anything, they've probably given up a fair amount of yield because they've been so conservative. But no monkey business. And every time I deal with state and local government, you know, I get somebody who's competent, who's perfectly pleasant, but tough. And it's certainly reflected if you look at their pension fund arrangements. If you come to Tennessee, people live much more modestly. We have a very high state tax income, no income income tax, but sales tax. Anyway, so the Tennessee system, between a modest home base and the way the state handles its budget, and my local area, if you go to our city council meeting once a year, the city council meets with the mayor, and the first thing they do is they open the mail, they go through the bills, and they write the checks. There is no staff. We don't pay them. And that's one of the reasons my property taxes are so low. So you're talking about a very modest operation that never built up the overhead that you see happen around the country. Now, if you look at where we are in terms of economic outlook, I've enjoyed a lot less capital gains over the last, you know, since 2000 on my property than I would have if I was in Chicago. But it also means now I've got enormous protection from what could happen on the state and local government front, and what could happen in terms of inflation. If inflation hits, how hard my overhead could be hit by a general inflation, which I think is very significant. And if we get a big fall in the dollar, it could be even more significant. It's very interesting. I sat down an exercise 2 years ago looking at all of this, and I said, okay, if when I started Hamilton, instead of doing Hamilton, I had just invested my money in what I thought would go up during this period, how much would I be worth? And I said, I'd probably be worth at a minimum about $40 million. And I was showing that to a very good friend, and she looked at me and she said, yes, but you'd be dead. And I said, you're right. I would be dead, because if you look at what I would have had to live with and emotionally tolerate, I'm not someone who can watch people being genocide around me and do nothing. And, you know, to do that would literally have killed me. And of course, that I would have stayed dependent on the traditional healthcare system and all the traditional systems, and those would definitely have killed me. So it's a very unorthodox pathway I've taken, but, you know, I have constantly tried to move away from untrustworthy systems towards trustworthy systems. And I have to tell you, if you look at my experiences with the 401k system, with federal enforcement, with the pension fund system, again, with a huge, one of the largest multinational banks in the world, what I found is all of these different systems are corrupt and completely untrustworthy. Not to say we can't hold their feet to the fire, and not to say that they're all corrupt. It really, you know, if I was looking at your situation, I'd have to look at the specifics to make sure. But if you take someone who's in a corrupt 401k situation and in a corrupt pension fund system, and then in a state and local government that's got huge unfunding and tremendous political corruption like Chicago, you're talking about a financial statement and a balance sheet that can really get harmed. So to me, there are great benefits of being outside of the pension fund system or outside of the systems. And if you look at the choices I've made, whether it's to keep cycling money out on the personal loan and gift circuit, or stay out of 401ks and avoid having that partnership with the federal government, or the way I handled healthcare, I'm very pleased with my decisions. And I think ultimately, when we go out 10 years and look back, I think I will have been dramatically better off for going the way I did. Okay, total economic returns. I want to talk a little bit about the pension fund's role in what they're financing. If you and I put money in a company that's destroying the world but making vast amounts of money doing it, we can say, well, you know, I'm making money, the company's making money. If you're a pension fund and you're basically investing $25 trillion of retirement savings, you know, it doesn't work that way, because if you're making money on things that destroy the overall economy, or destroy the health and well-being of the population, ultimately the harm done to the whole is going to shrink the total pie. And so you're big enough that you ought to be able to relate and understand the total pie. And if you look at countries where their sovereign wealth funds or their pension funds have taken a very serious interest in long-term strategic thinking about what can make the pie as big as possible, they have not only much better records than the United States in terms of performing on their funds, but they have a lot more support and participation and trust by the general population. And so, and it's remarkable if you look at the shenanigans that U.S. pension funds have been financing all along. You know, you would think they would outperform the benchmark by a lot because they're financing. If you look at the stuff they're financing, whether it's pharmaceuticals or crazy healthcare or GMO foods or all the things that are ballooning their healthcare expenses, you know, so you tear your hair out, you see a state and local fund that says, you know, that the healthcare expenses are killing them. It's, you know, you look at their portfolio and you say, you're killing yourself. You're financing all the things that are causing the ballooning of your healthcare expenses. Why are you doing it? It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so it's a long and complicated conversation, but we keep trying to make money by doing things which are have a very negative return, or pension funds are tolerating government having a negative return on investment, which arguably does pump up the corporate profits and corporate stocks, but ultimately, again, you shrink the pie. If you look at some of the stories I posted in News Trends and Stories in Part 1, one of the top stories is the bull market in equities. And I posted some very good articles in Jeremy Grantham about how the political process has been engineered to support corporate monopolies, big corporate monopolies. And the result, of course, is a much less dynamic economy. And so now you have Jeremy Grantham saying what I've been saying for 20 years, you know, yes, Virginia, there is a conspiracy. Interestingly enough, we just had Jana Hedge Fund and CalSTRS, the other big California public pension fund, bring a sort of corporate action forward to Apple saying, what are you doing to make sure iPhones are not addicting our children? You know, addicted children, you know, cannot be good for returns in the long run. They're absolutely right. But you had more than a few investors saying, what do you mean? Addiction is great for profits. I put one of those up as a quote on one of my Twitter. I tweeted it out. Anyway, there is now, for a variety of reasons, much interest in what the long-term impact on productivity and the economy is of different kinds of investments. And whereas pension funds, relative to anything else going in the United States, have tried to provide real leadership there and have had a lot of great successes, if you look at what is going on, we are financing deeply negative total economic returns on many, many parts of everyone's portfolio. And the time has come to do something about it. If we're going to really solve the problem, we have to pay attention to the analytics of what the total economic returns are and not do things that are shooting ourselves in the foot. Okay, a couple other issues I wanted to mention, which I think are very strategically important when you listen to the official narrative on pension funds. I clearly think when you look at the extensive underfunding of some of the state funds, some of the union funds, or you look at the returns, I think there are significant governance issues with many different kinds of pension funds. First, who gets appointed? So where government appointments are involved, who gets appointed and why? And then ultimately, who has a control file? Across all of our society, we are watching, you know, invisible in many cases, but physical force and violence, or legal and financial violence, literally, being used to influence people in any position that can influence lots of money. You know, my bet is there are plenty of people on the boards of trustees or in the governance structure on pension funds or running money for pension funds who have a control file. And that means for that reason or because of a variety of different other threats, they literally cannot say no. And so as long as that's the case, you have the governance and management of pension funds not run strictly for the benefit of the beneficiary. Instead, you end up with muddled obligations and conflicts of interest within the governance system, and that has to be addressed. And that's something that has to be addressed uniquely by every one group of beneficiaries in the current governance structure. The second thing is that we've been through what has been since 2008 or 2009 an unprecedented sort of bubble up in the stock market, and certainly the latest tax reform bill has kept it going. The question is, will it continue to crash up or will the bubble collapse? If the bubble collapses or the U.S. dollar loses a lot of value or gets or loses its status as the reserve currency, what we're going to see is a dramatic change in the fortunes to the negative of the pension funds. And it's clearly one of the things we need to think about. Another thing I want to point out is that falling interest rates have dramatically reduced performance across the board, yields across the board throughout the investment world, and that include pension funds. We now expect rising rates that could significantly reduce the bond price value or the value of the fixed income portfolios. What it can do is it can give more opportunity for yield. But there's no doubt I see the lower interest rates as literally a subsidy by private savings of the government, because you're basically providing very cheap cost of capital. Government who's turning around and providing very cheap cost of capital to the private side of the national security state. The earning assumptions have enormous swing when you determine the future liabilities and the comparison to assets on the and your unfunding status. Your assumption of future earnings can have a very dramatic impact. And if you look at some of the debates about how significant the underfunding is, some of the swing comes down to more conservative assumptions about what the earnings will be. And so this question of what the yields are going forward is very, very important. Now, I believe that yields are going to be significantly lower over the next 10 to 20 years than they were before. However, if you have a huge amount of technology which is suppressed, if you unsuppress it and introduce it, in fact, that could change in a heartbeat. If you look at the number one cost of input of U.S. corporations, it's energy, particularly manufacturing. You dramatically reduce the energy price with technology, and wow, more earnings through the roof. One of the links I put in the bibliography is a very interesting letter from one of the teachers' groups related to pensions, on an effort by the John and Laura Arnold Foundation to encourage defined contribution plans as opposed to defined benefit. Now, when you look at what's happening with the underfunding in pension benefits, it certainly your first conclusion would naturally be to say, oh, well, rather than promising a defined benefit and then struggling in the political or corporate process to make it happen, let's just set a certain aside as defined benefit. And then if the market or the dollar collapses, the beneficiary has to assume the risk. And we just can't have the state and local government or the corporations be responsible for coming up with a set benefit. It's just too risky and too difficult, so let's put it back on the beneficiary. Now, there's a certain logic in having the beneficiary rise and fall with the market, and I could see why that structure would be more flexible and more attractive to everyone, because you have the benefit of the beneficiary taking the risk, but you get to still control everything centrally. It's kind of the best of both worlds. Here's the problem. If you look at the bailouts and you look at the money missing from government and you look at quantitative easing and some of the other things, which all come together in what Catherine calls the financial coup d'etat, what you're seeing is that we're guaranteeing a no-risk, zero-cost of capital world to a set of insiders. And then turning around and saying, you know something, not only are we going to force you to finance our mistakes, you know, by bailing us out, what we're going to do is tell you that we're not going to bail out you when you have a legal contractual obligation. There was no legal and contractual obligation to provide the banks with $24 trillion. Plus, and there's certainly no legal mechanism under the law to disappear $21 trillion or whatever the real number is from the Department of Defense and Housing. So if you're creating a defined benefit world for a group of people who don't have any legal or contractual benefit, but you're saying, no, you won't maintain the defined benefits for this other group of people, aka outsiders, you want them to bear all the risk. So, you know, they bore the risk on the housing bubble and they bore the risk on the bailouts, and now they're going to bear the risk on the pension funds. And it's all sort of subtly done, and people seem a little bit not clear about it. But I assure you, if you sit back and you look at the rigging of that game, insiders versus outsiders, it's so outrageous. I struggle to find a way to describe it, which signifies how, you know, you're basically setting up a game where we finance you killing us. It's quite extraordinary. Another comment I wanted to make was on index funds. So if you compare the benchmark, the 60-40 benchmark that I describe in the chart at the top, or towards the top of the write-up, essentially, one might look at that and say, oh, well, maybe we should just index investments. And I would say, no, that's not a good idea. I mean, you can do some index. The challenge that we have is that the index system from the beginning was always designed to depend on markets and on some active managers and brokers and other people who do or pay for analysis. We were hoping for that segment of the market that was actively managing to do the analysis and for the market to do the pricing that would keep everything clean. So you have a certain discipline coming in the market that makes sure fraud and funny business isn't going on. And that capacity comes from either the market pricing or it comes from a group of people who are paid to do it because of the flow of fees to active management. When you take those two things out, so we're taking out the market competition as a result of government basically sort of actively and central banks actively managing markets. So we're losing honest prices and have for a while now. And then you index everything and you take out analysts who are really checking and digging in and questioning and making a difference to the, you know, the pricing and the market function. you know, then everybody is just flying blind, and there's no market discipline in there whatsoever. The question is, who's going to provide the market discipline? And more often than you're not going to have market discipline. You're going to have Mr. Global and Mr. Global's minions directing politically. And then you can really get into a mess. If you took all the pension funds and put them into index funds and didn't have them yapping about things like Apple iPhones addicting children, and you didn't have them doing the kind of, or hiring managers that do the kind of analysis to make sure, do we really want to buy this stock? You're taking out the last remnants of market discipline, and that's going to get the whole society can literally take all of its capital and run off a cliff, because index can make you very, very stupid. That said, you can't keep going on significantly underperforming the benchmark. So the question is why, and how do you turn that around, which gets us back to the deep state drain. Finally, there's been a process over the last 20, 30 years where we get more sort of smart guys starting firms, hedge funds, private equity firms, LBO firms. And what they're doing is they're moving to the front end of the investment process. They're buying companies before they go into IPO. They're doing a series of things that skim fees and returns. Now, interestingly enough, many of those firms are financed by the pension funds, and you almost want to scratch your head and say, why are you financing them doing things that skim off the front end ahead of what you get? And I suspect that's part of what's going on, and they're using the pension funds for what we used to call dumb money. You know, they're certainly never going to tell the pension fund that, but that is essentially what's happening. And I think part of the lower returns over the last 10 years is the fact that you've got a larger and larger world of different players in different areas, particularly in the alternative investment portfolio at pension funds, that have figured out how to skim things out in a way which is ultimately, I think, harming the big institutional investors, including pension funds. Okay, so let me bring this down to bottom line. I have a little graphic. You know, I love those graphics that say, keep calm and do math. So let's look at the numbers. Let's leave Social Security out and say on our $25 trillion that the unfunding is, you guess the number, $5 to $10 trillion. So let's say we have a $5 to $10 trillion hole on pension funds, and that doesn't include healthcare, because healthcare is a, you know, sort of a more complex story. So we have $5 to $10 trillion. Well, that sounds like a huge amount of money, but is it really? Is it really? I mean, it's only 10% of $50 trillion, which between $21 trillion missing from HUD, $24 to $26 trillion on the bailouts, more missing money. In Iraq, we certainly spent $6 or $7 trillion on wars in the Middle East. We have $4 trillion plus in quantitative easing, and my guess it's probably much bigger. We have the pump and dump of the internet and telecom stocks. You know, we have Madoff and a number of big financial frauds like that. We have invaluable, the most valuable technology in the world, sort of laundered out into private corporations. Other assets transferred and stolen. We have the money spent to sort of guarantee no risk for the world that's too big to fail or too rich or too powerful to fail. I could go on and on and on and on and on, but let's just say that number conservatively is $50 trillion. $5 trillion is only 10% of that. $10 trillion is only 20% of that. You know, what is the problem? Where's the problem? If it's not a problem for $21 trillion to go missing from HUD, I assure you, fixing whatever pension fund problem is there is not difficult, but you have to want to. And that's the problem. So it gets back to what I said before. I don't think we have an underfunding. I think we have a political strategic decision made in the early 90s and mid 90s to basically abrogate a significant amount of the pension fund obligations and to make sure that they gotten the assets all out of those systems and moved over into new systems so that when the day came that the boomers wanted their dollar back, it wouldn't be there. It would be someplace else. And if they had to give money back in the pension fund, it wouldn't hurt it because they had stolen sufficient amounts of money to be able to keep that $2 coming every year, or to keep the $1 coming and not to have to give the dollar back. So when you get a perspective of where the money is and how the money works, what you realize is, oh, we don't have a financial problem. We have a political problem. And the reason we have this problem is because the federal government and business leadership, leadership of the country, have been steadily doing things for 20 years that would, of course, result in this problem. You know, think of it this way. It's not a crisis. It's a plan. So what's the opportunity? The opportunity is, in fact, if you could clean up the integrity of the governance, you could introduce new technology into our economy, you could optimize the well-being and local circulation of equity, and you could take government investment and turn it from a negative to a positive return on investment. There are significant ways we have of dramatically improving productivity and of dramatically improving returns on investment and generating significant capital gains. We also have ways of saving money, like not spending $1 trillion a year on, well, if you look at the total global numbers out of the Swedish Institute, we're probably headed towards 1.5 trillion, if not 2 trillion globally. So there are many, many different opportunities. The reality is each one of us is struggling to deal with our own individual situation, and we're not coming together and saying, okay, let's do this, whether it's in my local area, whether in my state. Now, that's the opportunity to start to do it. You know, but it's going to come back to the fact that we have a lawlessness problem. And the question for all of us is, how are we going to start to enforce the laws? So if you go to constitution.salieri.com or missingmoney.salieri.com, you'll see more and more that we're growing every day to try and help people think through, okay, how are we going to enforce the laws? How are we going to bring transparency to government budgets and financials? Because what we're going to need to do to make all of this work is a very significant reengineering, among other things, of how government money works and integrating new technology that can really kickstart productivity. What you'll see with the tax reform is a lot of capital repatriated that is going to start to do that. The question is where, how, what are the details going to be? We don't know. But what I will tell you is, environmental problems aside, and I don't underestimate those, there is no reason for poverty on the planet. The way you end poverty is you create enormous wealth. All of these things in combination in the United States could create mind-boggling greater wealth than we have today. Again, subject to the environmental problems. Who knows what the truth is there? Okay, so what can you do? I cannot tell you how important it is to change the narrative, because if you look at the official narrative, which has a lot of great facts and data and information in it, it's, oh God, we didn't save enough. It's our fault. We're to blame. And now, you know, we haven't been sufficiently disciplined, so now we're just going to have to cut benefits and cut benefits and cut benefits and cut benefit. I want to change the narrative, which is, well, wait a minute, if $21 trillion can disappear from HUD and DOD, let's just get it back and, you know, and fully fund the pension funds. What's the problem? Or if we can loan 24 to 26 or gift to the banks 24 to 26 trillion, what's the problem? Why can't we do the same for our pension funds? So it's really important to change the narrative. And again, we don't have a pension fund crisis. We have a political crisis. And the pension funds are a symptom. So let's start to change the narrative, because it will have a tremendous difference to the policies that impact what happens over the next 5 to 10 years if we can change the narrative. The second thing is, it's really important that you sit down and look at what it's going to do to your financial statement and balance sheet for the underfunding problems that you're connected to come to fruition. You are a taxpayer, both federally and state and local. I want you to take a look at where your state is and what could happen if the state started to amortize its unfunded liabilities. What would that mean to you as a taxpayer? What is it going to cost you? And then as a beneficiary, if you're expecting to receive an income from a pension fund, I want you to start understanding what its funding ratios are and whether or not there's a problem and whether or not you and your fellow beneficiaries need to do something. It's very interesting. There was a recent survey, which I posted at the Bibliography, that pointed out, they did a survey, and it was astonishing the percentage of people who thought their pension fund was fully funded and didn't realize there was a problem. The third thing I think is, I think we got ourselves in trouble when we decided to basically dedicate a cash flow for central control, leaving the central control to think it's their money, not ours. And you solve that by building independent family wealth. The reality is, you can't do that unless you have to address either pathway. You have to address the integrity issues, because you can't build independent family wealth if you've got the feds running around pumping and dumping and injecting QE, to all your competitors. So, building, it's not so simple as saying, oh, well, we're not going to play in your pension funds. We're just going to go off and build our independent family wealth. We've got a sheriff of Nottingham abroad in the land, and your family wealth isn't safe, just like your pension fund isn't safe. And the third thing is, I will say the bigger car crash, again, is not the pension funds. The bigger car crash is the healthcare. And we've had two, in the last year, we've had two Salier reports talking about this, one with Dr. Laura Thompson and one just recently with Joe Klein. If you look at the environmental problems causing health and health problems and disease, whether GMO foods or fluoride in the water or heavy metals spraying in the global spraying, all of these things are significantly impacting health and life expectancy. And the traditional medical system cannot help you. You're going to need to take charge of your health and do something about it. And there are many different things you can do. We talk a lot about it on the Salier Report. But if you look at the squeeze that's coming in healthcare, you need to take charge and you need to be the master of your own health wherever possible. So those are my comments on pension funds. We have a political problem. We don't have a financial problem. But that political problem, if we can't fix it or don't fix it, is going to create a real financial crisis, whether it's in our lives or in the lives of family and friends or people we care about. And depending on how bad it gets, it could have a tremendous impact. So it's time to change the narrative. And I think the U.S. pension funds have a deep state drain, like just about everything else going on in the United States. And we're getting to the point where there is no middle of the road. We're going to have to take action and do what we can to bring back the law in this society. As I said, the web presentation will be finished over the coming week, and there's lots of great, useful stuff in the annual wrap-up. We should have, once we finish the web presentation, we'll do the PDF and flipbook and then publish the hard copy. So those will be rolling out, and we'll keep you informed. But now we've done all four parts: News Trends and Story Part 1, News Trends and Story Part 2, very juicy conversation with Dr. Joseph Farrell, the equity overview with a discussion with Franklin on precious metals, and then the Chartology from Rambus, outstanding 2017 review, and a very good sense of the possibility that the crash up could continue. And now a review of pension funds. It's time to change the narrative, because we do believe your pension fund. I know my pension fund has a deep state drain. Anyway, so ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the 2017 annual wrap-up. I look forward to publishing the first quarter wrap-up, which is going to be on the space-based economy. Very important primary trend in the investment markets and in our lives. So the leadership is committed to becoming a multiplanetary civilization. I think that is something that's very important to do. As a society and as a species, we shouldn't bet the ranch on one planet, no matter how beautiful and wonderful it is and how much better care we should take of it. So let me close by saying, as I always do, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.